looking again actually at Betsy Hyman's work, if you look at Reservoir Dogs, the thing that struck me that just was astonishing is that the famous shot of them all walking along in the black suits at the beginning, this sort of French New Wave thing, they're not actually wearing black suits. I think at least three of them have got black jeans on. I think it's Michael Madsen who's got a mismatched jacket and trousers. The only one who's actually got a suit on, which was provided by Agnes B, was Harvey Keitel, because he knew her and she said, yeah, sure, we can have a suit. The rest of them were just cobbled together as best she could to give this look. She knew, and Quentin knew, that the camera wouldn't really pick up on this. It wasn't supposed to be black jeans and a black jacket, but nobody noticed. For years afterwards, there was a stag do. I mean, everyone dressed up in black suits walking around. We had a Reservoir Dogs. Like, honestly, guys, you could have just bunged your jacket with a pair of jeans. Because that's it was stuff like that I find really interesting, that it becomes a myth.
The author of the new book, Clothes on Film, Christopher Laverty. We'll take a closer look at how the worlds of fashion and film often collide today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
After my first visit to Mongolia, I realized just how vast and cinematic this landscape is. And I thought, when we come back, I'm going to have to do justice to this. And we're going to have to get up in the air.
Director Otto Bell takes us to the peaks of Mongolia on the back of a golden eagle with his stunning new documentary film, The Eagle Huntress. And if you've ever reminisced about a time in life when your biggest concern was colouring inside the lines, well, stay tuned, we have the perfect movie magazine for you.
I guess it's the equivalent of, like, super, super hard Sudoku. It needs to be something that can actually expand over a certain length of time, that occupies your mind for a bit longer than maybe you think it would.
A lesson in using crayons as an adult. Today on The Cinema Show, here on Monocle 24. Today we're taking flight high over the mountaintops of Mongolia with a young girl named Aishalpan and one enormous golden eagle. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The Eagle Huntress is a new documentary film that follows a young girl living in one of the most remote places on the planet. Aishalpan comes from a long family line of eagle hunters, 12 generations of them. She wants to carry on the tradition, but despite her fierce determination, talent and toughness, there's one major obstacle. Eagle hunting is an almost exclusively male occupation. Needless to say, that doesn't stop her. In addition to its life-affirming story, the film also features some of the most breathtaking cinematography you're ever likely to witness. I spoke to the director of The Eagle Huntress, Otto Bell.
Traditionally, there have been instances of women stepping into this realm, but it's very rare. Traditionally, it's a pastime that's handed down from father to son, and it's very sort of intricately tied to identity and how men define their masculinity out there. And she comes from a long line of eagle hunters. Her father, her grandfather, it goes back about 12 generations in her family. And she's always been transfixed by eagles. Her mother tells me about, like, how she would crawl over to them in the, because they live in the house in Mongolia, well, the yurt, the gur, as they call it out there. But so she's always been transfixed by it. The backstory is her brother got drafted off to the army. She took over a lot of his day-to-day chores, jobs which were typically deemed to be for a man, you know, helping with the herding and things like that. She said to her dad, well, I'm doing all of these men's jobs. Why can't I, you know, teach me the basics with the bird? And he did.
So often we hear about places like Mongolia, and that's described as the sort of like the edge of human existence.
Yeah.
But then you meet people like this, and you sort of get this new understanding of how people live, but also their relationship with the world around them. And I mean, it's a lot more intense, their relationship with their environment, for obvious reasons, isn't it?
No, absolutely. It is the most remote part of the least populated country in the world. So you're right, it does. It feels like the edge of the world. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of a deeply foreign film. You know, it's in Kazakh. it follows this ancient tradition about which we know little. But although the kind of the wrapping is exotic, the themes, I think, that surface in the film are pretty universal.
I heard one person remarking that they'd gone to see this film in New York not too long after a certain election that took place fairly recently. And yeah. One of the points that they picked up was that it was just so reaffirming to see a story taking place in a completely different part of the world where those sorts of issues couldn't be further from people's list of things that matter. And yet it's a story all about how girls can go out there and do whatever they want to do.
Yes. I'm pretty happy it's out there in the world right now. I think it's a pretty good antidote to this poisonous locker room talk that is going around right now. Ultimately, I want young girls and boys to leave the cinema feeling like they can do anything, right? So long as they work hard, so long as they're determined.
While they're in the cinema, one could imagine that they could quite literally fly, because a lot of the cinematography that's in this film actually quite literally makes you feel like you're swooping through the skies. I mean, it's quite astonishing to think that you achieved this sort of look and feel to the film, given how small your crew was.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I can imagine that being in those sorts of locations, you wouldn't want to be carting around 60-plus people with you, would you?
No. I mean, I don't believe in large crews. I don't think they yield intimate results. That said, I couldn't afford one. I made this film with my own money, with my life savings. I actually had to get money from the bank as well. I went into debt for the first time in my life, which was, it was all quite hairy. But I was very lucky in that my long-term director of photography, Simon Niblett, you know, he's a pioneer of drone photography. After my first visit to Mongolia, I realized just how vast and cinematic this landscape is. And I thought, when we come back, I'm going to have to do justice to this. And we're going to have to get up in the air. You know, also, it's a film about eagles, you know, so you kind of have to have the bird's eye point of view. You know, we threw the kitchen sink at it. We made the film with the crew of three people, but I hope it feels like 30 people made it. And Simon brought his drone. We brought about 700 kilos of gear. And he built me this wonderful crane. It's 9 meters long, aluminium, and it folds away into a snowboard bag. So it only weighs about 25 kilos. And you can put it up in 5 minutes, you can take it down in 5 minutes. I got a dog harness from, you know, disaster zones. They'll send a dog into ruins with a camera on its back. I found that harness and I adapted it so it comfortably fit the eagle. You know, these are the largest species of golden eagle in the world. I mean, they're enormous. They've got about a 7-8 foot wingspan. Huge. Because I wanted that, literally, I wanted to fly with the bird, and we got it. Although it was sort of shoestring, we would be quite thoughtful about it. So, for example, the steel, where she climbs down the side of the cliff and takes the baby eaglet from the nest. Now, that we did that in one take. That was 12 minutes. Because we had the mother eagle circling above us. So we couldn't sort of redo anything. Now, for that one, I shot it from three angles. I had a cameraman on the ground because he was afraid of heights. He wouldn't go up the mountain. And I had me and Asher, it was in this case, the stills photographer. He and I scrambled down the side of the mountain as well. And we were kind of on a ledge next door to the nest. But in this instance, we put it underneath Ashil Pan's cardigan, and it gave us just some lovely, you know, it took us into the nest.
Otto Bell, director of the new documentary film, The Eagle Huntress. It was released in the US last month and will hit UK theatres in the coming days. Now remember those glasses Christopher Reeve wore as Clark Kent in the old Superman movies? Sure, the idea is to create what's surely the world's worst disguise so Lois Lane doesn't recognise him as the Man of Steel. But there's something more being said by his choice of eyewear.
awkwardly large, unfashionable, suggesting someone not quite up to speed with current trends. The clothes worn by actors on the screen are often just as representative of the character adorning them as our own clothes might be of us. Christopher Laverty is the creator of the Clothes on Film blog. He's just published his first book, Fashion in Film, and he popped into Midori House to walk me through some of his favourite examples of clues hidden away inside a character's choice of attire.
It was something that I was interested in, costume design, and I felt I knew a bit about. And no one else really seemed to be writing about it in anything more than just a fashion way, just pure fashion, as in what jacket Brad Pitt has worn in a film or something like that. So I wanted to dig beneath the surface a little bit and write some fairly academic articles and just bung them out there and see if anyone took any interest. And it was just one of those cases where it really took off. People really got interested in it very quickly. It went from like 5 readers a day to 50, and I think it's got like 5,000 now that just trawl the archives. I think, like I said, no one else was writing about that type of thing, the sort of the subtext of costume and why people wear what they do on screen, as opposed to anything more than just it looks good. I mean, the actual title, Fashion in Film, it's probably not really correct. You can have a fashion movie, but whether or not it's fashion in film, it actually becomes costume the moment it turns up in a film, but there are many fashionable things in a film. So what I wanted to do was approach it from a designer, a fashion designer angle. I mean, you read a lot about prominent designers providing things for movies. There was a thing with Rodarte a few years ago for Black Swan, who essentially said that they designed the costumes in the movie, which was incorrect. They'd worked on a couple of the tutus along with other people involved in a film, the director and the costume designer, Amy Westcott, who I actually got in contact with and was livid. She was like, I can't believe these women said are taking credit for work that we all did together.
When we talk about fashion on film, it does actually cease to become fashion and becomes a costume, officially at least, speaking officially. But that's sort of true to life as well, isn't it? There are some characters in real life that might seem to be wearing fashion, but indeed are actually more adorning themselves with a costume. I'm thinking of political identities. I just happened to turn over to page 31 of your book and have found a picture of Jane Fonda in the role of Nancy Reagan. Couldn't it be argued that politicians such as Nancy Reagan were in fact wearing a costume themselves because they had to become this public character that was perhaps a little bit separate to who they might be behind closed doors?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a costume and a uniform. If you think of Theresa May, who is now extremely well known for wearing those animal print kitten heels of hers, which apparently she has several pairs of. But it's coming to a point now, if anyone draws like a picture of her or something like that, they're probably going to put them in the picture now. It's become part of her uniform. And almost if she wants to change that, I'd be surprised if she's not being advised, actually keep this. It's becoming part of your iconography, okay? It is your uniform as a politician. It's something that gives her a particular sense of humour, I guess, for a not a particularly humorous-looking lady. but, yeah, it's like she takes on that as a costume, I think, after a while. And it's like, okay, this is my political uniform now to wear. You know, I put these on and I know, I mean, I don't know, maybe she fights against it, maybe I'm not being taken seriously, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't seem like she does, really. It's kind of that become her look. And it's the same, you know, with Nancy Reagan wearing Bill Blass all the time, who's seen as a very very safe designer for moneyed ladies. He dressed, I think, by his own admission. He was very much liked at the White House. He would get invited to a lot of parties, and he knew how to socialize. He was a good-looking man, and he was very charming. And I think he said something along the lines of, you know, I dress politicians' wives. That was kind of how he saw what he did. And he made some lovely clothes, but he very much saw that that was his niche. And that was their political uniform, I guess, or their costume, as you were saying.
We've started seeing trailers for the new film Jackie, which of course stars Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy. And she was obviously someone who personified her own very individual style. There's a well-known scene in Mad Men, the television series. Someone quips that if you look around in a room full of women, often you could divide them between the ones that want to be Jackie and the ones that want to be Marilyn.
So, I was thinking, women right now already have a fantasy, and it's not going up the Nile. It's right here in America. Jackie Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. Every single woman is one of them. Watch this. Jackie, Marilyn, Jackie, Marilyn. Well, Marilyn's really a Joan, not the other way around.
Obviously, it's a generalization and exaggeration, but I think it's a good way of illustrating just how dominant these particular styles were for that generation. Do you think there's an element of power to be had with maybe deciding or determining what your own particular individual style is?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Especially on screen, the most powerful, rigidly minded characters, if you like, tend to have a particular uniform and it's repeated. They will look a certain way throughout, because if someone dresses in totally different styles, it tends to sort of suggest a more fractured personality, someone that doesn't quite know who they are. You see them in different things. And after a while, it gets a little difficult when you're trying to follow someone on screen in that way. But also, that you see them as a little flighty, and they don't quite know who they are. But if someone, I think if you think of Kathleen Turner in Body Heat in the white suit, who wears pretty much the same type of ensemble all the way throughout. And you've got Sharon Stone, of course, who wears a similar white suit in Basic Instinct, the sort of devil in the white dress, if you like. It becomes a symbol of them. And if they dress similar throughout, it's seen as, in my mind at least, someone who's very focused. And in real life too, people who take on a particular look and run with it. I have a lot of respect for that, because it takes a lot of commitment, and some days you just want to get up and wear something a little different. But when you've adopted a particular look, of course, it also suggests a stubbornness, I guess, as far as personality is concerned. And that's also seen on screen, I think, because these characters I'm just talking about are, of course, incredibly focused and, well, actually homicidal, but it's not here nor there, I guess. But they're certainly very focused on what they do and who they are.
This is a world of hidden mics and two-way mirrors. A world where nothing is private.
Do you think we can do this?
Later in the week.
Do you think we can do this?
Harry Call is an expert. The best there is.
You think of Gene Hackman in The Conversation, when he wears this see-through raincoat throughout the film. It's a weird little item. It was literally a pocket raincoat, one of those ones you buy in a little pouch and you just pull it out. And I think the costume designer, she bought 2 dozen for the film because they would rip all the time, and it's just a cheap, nasty looking thing. But it became his uniform throughout. And actually, that's another great thing about costume, what I really love. If you watch the film closely, he only ever wears this raincoat in moments that are pertaining to the murder plot that he's investigating or part of. Any other moments in a film, he doesn't have it on. But at one point he dreams about the murder plot and he has the raincoat on then. I mean, the film's pretty ambivalent with its meaning, I guess. It's certainly looking at the ending, but I just love little moments like that. It seems to be that's his work mode. That's him when he's at work. And why he wears a see-through raincoat, I don't know. I don't mean a costume designer entirely knew. She was just told by Coppola to go and get him, and she did. But she thought it might be something to do with the fact that he's so paranoid about being bugged, so he could see anything that was put on him because he had this raincoat covering him. Now, stuff like that I find absolutely fascinating, because it tells you about a character, and at the same time, it powers a narrative as well. That's when I find costume design is really, really exciting, and tiny little subtextual moments like that.
I've got your ticket to New York. Q has repaired your wristwatch and some background material on Saint Monique.
Thank you, Moneypenny.
I'm sure the overburdened British taxpayer would be fascinated to know how the Special Ordnance Section disperses its funds. In future, Commander, allow me to suggest a perfectly adequate watchmaker just down the street.
Let's think of something like the Rolex watch, because that to me seems to be something that's always used to symbolise the same thing. Whenever I can think of it being used in films, it always seems to suggest that this character is wealthy, successful, and quite happy and confident enough to flaunt that in public.
I think it can suggest class as well, but buying into class more than necessarily being born with it. If you think of James Bond, who is a man who created himself, who grew up and found this identity of this man who knew all the best wines and the best wore the best suits and best car and was just a very cultured, intelligent, traveled man. He created that, and he must have thought to himself, certainly in the movie version, this is the character I'm thinking of in a moment, not necessarily one from the books, but the movie version is a guy that would have thought, okay, what would a man like me wear? This guy that I'm trying to be, this guy who knows all the best food and the best restaurants, what would he wear? He'd wear a Rolex, naturally. That's what he would pick up. Of course, now he doesn't actually wear a Rolex anymore in the movies, but in the older ones, the 60s, 70s, by and large, he did. But that was about him creating that personality and other people seeing him that way. If they saw him flash the watch, they would have seen, looked at him, oh, there's a man with taste. Look at his suit. Look at his watch. He knows what he's doing. He's buying into that. I think nowadays it's become a slightly more flashy statement, depending on the style of watch, I guess. But even someone like Michael Caine's character in Get Carter, who is a gangster, wears nice suits, and obviously has a lot of money. But it's just a ruthless, homicidal maniac, frankly. But I still don't mean he wants to be part of another scene, part of a better scene. I think he's elevated himself out of the slums. So of course what he goes and buys is a Rolex. I've got some money, I want a good watch, I'm gonna buy a Rolex. And that's what that says about him. We see it in the movie and it's like, of course he'd wear a Rolex. What else would he wear? It makes perfect sense. It fits in perfectly with the character. Nothing jars, it fits in perfectly.
Christopher Laverty, author of the new book Fashion in Film, which is available right now, just in time for Christmas. Coming up next, it's time to reach for your favourite box of coloured pencils and join the world's most beautiful movie magazine for a lesson in colouring in. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. If you've ever watched a Star Wars movie and wondered how Yoda might look with bright pink skin, or imagined Princess Leia with two deep green buns affixed to the side of her head, well, we've got the magazine for you. The latest issue of Little White Lies is taking its reputation for eye-catching covers adorned with elaborate original artworks one step further, with a special colour-in cover. And they've even got an evening coming up for all those eager artists who prefer colouring collectively. David Jenkins is the magazine's editor. He joins me here now. David, explain to me the idea behind this latest cover.
So for our recent issue of the magazine, which is inspired by the film Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, we decided to make the illustration element of the mag monochrome. We would then invite our readers to colour it in. And obviously everyone knows that colouring in is the new free form of therapy. Well, it's not free because you need to get the materials.
I recently learned this, that colouring in wasn't actually always considered a children's pastime.
Well, I guess it might have something to do with this sort of cyclical nature of publishing, really, because, I mean, you know, now they have the sort of Penguin books that have now come back as kind of ironic adult versions of the children's versions.
I've seen a lot of them floating around lately.
And now you get the adult colouring books, which kind of are, you know, they're very intricate patterns that aren't really... They're not the kind of fun, silly things that are for kids, you know. Some of the, you know, you also have the ironic ones, which are like, you know, colour in Tom Hiddleston and colour in Ryan Gosling and stuff like that. When we made this issue, the idea of it was that the images, the monochrome images, would kind of work as art in their own right. I mean, we didn't build them specifically with the view that they were going to be coloured, that they had to be coloured in, but they just could be. Since the mag came out, we've just had tons of people connecting with us through social media, showing us the pictures of their coloured in covers. At 71A Gallery, we're having hosting an event where people can come down, have some drinks, get a magazine, colour in the cover with us, listen to some music, and all our art directors are going to be there to
help out with colour choices.
Exactly, and offer advice on colour schemes and whatnot.
Now, I want to know what sort of stationery you'll have on offer, though, because I happen to quite enjoy the noise of the pencil scraping against the paper. But not all markers are equal when it comes to their audible integrity. So I'm wondering, because I can imagine having a lot of people collected in the same room, all doing the same colouring activity. If everyone is completely silent, that would be quite a lovely noise coming off those pages.
Yeah, and I think that, no, the sound, I think different pens make different sounds. So, I mean, you're going to have this kind of symphony of pen noises coming out with, you know, touch wood. I mean, we're going to have, like, all different things on offer. I mean, there's just going to be that, you know, we're going to have crayons, we're going to have pencils. So when I coloured mine in, I actually borrowed from our art director these really quite fancy paint pens, which are kind of, they're like, they look like felt tip pens, but they actually have a kind of water-based paint in them. And they create these really, like, it's like it had been printed. I mean, it looks amazing. So we're going to have some of them floating around as well. And for me, they seem to work the best on this, on the kind of dimensions of this cover and the kind of filling in the white spaces. So,
I mean, your covers are very, very well known, even to people who might not ordinarily buy a movie magazine. My mother is visiting London at the moment, and she came back to my house recently with a copy of Little White Lies. She'd picked it up simply because she thought it looked so fascinating and different to everything else on the newsstand. When it comes to colouring in that sort of image, though, I mean, it sounds like it could be relatively complex. Not that I want to say colouring in sounds complex, but some of the images that you have are actually quite elaborate.
That is the sort of one of the things of the adult colouring in craze. I mean, I guess it's the equivalent of like super, super hard Sudoku. It needs to be something that can actually expand over a certain length of time, that occupies your mind for a bit longer than maybe you think it would. That kind of being very, very considerate about your colour choices, your colour scheme, and how well you do everything to make this image look as immaculate as it can is just part of the appeal of it. I mean, one of the issues, I guess, is that we consider our magazine to be a kind of quite pristine object that we, you know, we don't want people to like tear it or mark it or do, you know, we make the magazine in the hope that people will keep it. And I think, you know, we did have a lot of discussions about like, oh, but do we want people like drawing on the magazine and ruining it for you know, maybe they'll have to buy two copies, one to put in the vault for the grandkids and one to muck up. And it's great that the response has been just great, that people have actually been willing to do it and not feeling that they've been ruining the mag at all. And it's just a sort of, you know, added extra bonus feature to covering possibly the most well-known art franchise of this and the last century.
David Jenkins from Little White Lies magazine. The Rogue One Colouring In evening is happening this Monday, the 12th of December at the 71A Gallery here in London. And that's it for today's show. Next week, it is our Christmas special.
Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!
We'll count down our favourite festive films and take a peek inside the cinema show's Christmas gift bag. Plus, we'll hear from the artist Lucy Raven, who's here in London curating a special series of films, many of which are screening inside a purpose-built theatre at the Serpentine Gallery. The screenings coincide with Lucy's show at the gallery too. Check out serpentinegalleries.org for details. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio, and a very happy 100th birthday to the screen legend Kirk Douglas. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.